Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Guess what, Lorraine?
Tell me, Trish.
Well, we've had possibly the best compliment I think we are ever going to get.
Am I going to like it?
Oh, you are. I think you are. I think he's going to make you laugh. My lovely friend Sue, who I've known for years, who lives in Australia, sent me a little message telling us how much she loved the podcast and the fact that she thinks we are the menopausal Morecambe and Wise.
Menopausal Morecambe and Wise. Do you know my favourite Morecambe and Wise joke? Can I tell it to you?
Which one is it?
Every time a police car with a siren on goes by, you have to say, he's not going to sell many ice creams going that fast.
That's a classic Eric, isn't it? When they're in bed in their strange bedroom. Anyway, I think we should challenge ourselves to try and get a little Morecambe and Wise joke now into every episode.
I'm going to get you a badge with menopausal Morecambe and Wise on it.
Hello. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Trish Halpin.
And I'm Lorraine Candy, and we're on a mission to help you make the most of your magnificent midlife. We'll be tackling everything from mind and body wellness to HRT and your sex drive. Trish and I are here to help you have a stylish second act and answer all your midlife questions on fashion, beauty, careers, relationships, family, and as always, the challenges and joys of parenting teens.
In today's episode, we'll be discussing middle age rage. Yes, I think you probably all know what we're talking about. It's that illogical and extreme fury that seems to turn up like an uninvited guest right in the middle of midlife. You thought you'd be content, but instead you're just cross. So what is that all about?
I'm always cross, aren't I, Trish? So I can hear you on that. Mm-hmm. We're also going to be giving some handy tips on how to be more organised now that you are a proper grown-up for our section, How to Win at Midlife.
And we'll also be posing the question this week, what do you do if your teen stops communicating with you?
Yeah. And today's guest is writer Rosie Green, whose new book, How to Heal a Broken Heart, is out in February. Rosie, who is 45, will be talking to us about love, sex and relationships in midlife. Her partner of 26 years left unexpectedly just before Christmas 2018. But Rosie, who's a fashion and beauty journalist, has built a happy new life with her family. And we hear how she came back from the brink of loneliness and despair.
And we'll be rounding off the show with some nostalgia noodling. But just a reminder as well, please, we love to hear from you. We love to hear your midlife lessons and experiences, either on our Facebook group, our Instagram, or by email at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com.
And of course, if you missed any of series one or two, or even the last few episodes, then they're all on your usual podcast provider, so you can catch up.
Let's get started with some of our jibber jabber, because we do love to chat about the things we thought we might be in midlife and whether or not we've achieved them and if they really actually matter anyway. This week, we're pondering on whether or not we're content. Lorraine, are you content?
Well, it's hard to tell because of the midlife rage, which was something I didn't think it would happen to me. It's about sort of being kind of overwhelmed, isn't it? And kind of overheated and overloaded, and it's actually a recognized symptom of the menopause, midlife rage, or the perimenopause. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's kind of just being a bit cross with things. It's absolutely murderous, isn't it, this rage? It's a rage I've never experienced before. And I am a woman who once went on an anger management course for a piece I was writing, when I suggested to the staff that we write a piece about anger management, and could they find someone who could do it? They said, why don't you do it? Which you know, I know about rage, but I had no idea that this rage was going to happen. Obviously, it's to do with the estrogen dropping. It's very, very common, isn't it? Do you get the rage, Trish?
Not anymore, because mine went after the HRT. And I think there does come a point where it does stop, thank God. But it was not good.
The thing is, Trish, no one told us that this rage was coming. It's kind of a bit of a shock. So I remember back to my mum, who would have been around the perimenopausal age, getting very cross, unusually cross. She's a very calm, patient woman. And suddenly she was getting very, very cross about things. And I remember one Christmas day where the food was burnt. She wasn't a great cook, it wasn't her favourite thing. And she took it out of the oven and she was so cross, she just threw it all at the shut patio window. And I just remember watching it all, me and my sister watching it all slide down the window, oh, thinking, oh my what God, what do we have now?
Oh no!
Was your mum cross?
Yeah, well, my mother's was also a kitchen fury.
They were trapped there, weren't they?
I know, poor woman. It was the banging of the pots and pans. We just knew to skedaddle upstairs when the banging started. Bang, crash, putting pans away, getting pans out, putting them in the sink, banging them. Poor woman. And obviously we just sort of ran
midlife
for the hills.
Midlife rage.
But dealing with the rage, getting rid of the rage, it's given me some headspace for the first time in years to think about whether or not I am content. And I think that I read somewhere that when you are content, you are at peace with your life and the choices you've made, and whether that's your partner, your career, your possessions, and you're not constantly looking for more or better things to be satisfied with. So have you got to any point where you've got some clarity on that?
Well, I have. Yeah, I think it's interesting because I'm just about to read Untamed, the Glennon Doyle book, which has been a massive number one bestseller. This is a woman who left a very unhappy marriage, went to AA, met the love of her life and married her, another woman. So one of the things that she talks about in it and being content and what content is realizing, and she realized this when she got sober, you can feel all the feelings. Mm-hmm. That, you know, a lot of the time we're just distracting ourselves and the rage is distracting us and we're cross that we're cross. But actually, it's okay to feel rage. It's okay to feel sad. All the feelings is quite hard to deal with all of the mm-hmm. time. But once you have realized that you're going to feel all these feelings and they're going to be coming at you and you know you can sort of survive that, then you reach a kind of level of peace, a sort of happiness with yourself. When I guess once you realize you don't have to be incredibly happy all the time, you're not striving for something all the time, you're not questioning all the time, you're not searching, you're just in the moment dealing with good and bad feelings. I think that makes me feel like I might be heading towards
people. Yeah, well, I think I'm finding it in funny little day-to-day moments where it often involves our kids rolling their eyes in absolute horror at Neil and I, because
it's kind of... You have just put your glass, two pairs of glasses
on. Yeah, I did just put two pairs of glasses on. Exactly. That's an eye-rolling moment. It's kind of like when you find pleasure or get excited about some like really simple little things. Shall I tell you a couple of my little things that make the kids eye rolls?
Are they going to make me review our friendship?
Yes, very likely. It involves spotting things like a goldfinch in the garden. Oh, that gets Neil and I very excited.
Does it?
And also watching things on TV like The Repair Shop. Have you watched The Repair Shop?
I just can't watch it, Trish.
Oh,
I can't.
My God.
I can't think of anything more boring. My husband loves it. to fix it.
Yeah, no, it's an hour of feeling pure contentment and kind of happiness of life and people and experiences and craftsmanship. It's a whole other episode, I think, The Repair Shop.
It sounds deathly dull to me. But Trish, is that not about settling? Because there is in our interview, one of the interviews with one of the guests, we said, it's just that running at life at 100 miles an hour. She says, children run at life at 100 miles an hour. But we all slow down when we get older. Is that not what I would call settling?
No, I don't think it is. I think settling is when you're putting up with things like a job or a relationship, because it's kind of easier to do than actually shake things up and go for what you really want in life. So I think that's kind of settling. But being content is about finding that peace and that kind of like, this is an okay decision. It might be like you do something that you weren't expecting to do, but actually it's okay. So you carry on with that. But it's like when it stops being okay, that's when, you know, you might need a little kind of red flag and start to kind of review things. But I think it's one of the great things about getting older is
feeling content. And I think once you've sorted out the rage, which is very easily done, you can make lifestyle changes, you can replace the estrogen with and testosterone with HRT. Once you've sorted out the rage, it's a little bit like you can deal with it or put it to good use. There is a quote about anger, which is that it's like water. It takes the form of the container that it's in. So you can just let it flow and use it to do positive things in life. Use that as an energy. That's how I'm seeing my rage, yes, as an energy to do positive things.
We had a nice little review actually on the site where you get your podcast from, and this is from Tibbs Tabs Tobbs, who says, "Thank you, ladies. I'm learning so much about what's occurring to me. Fascinated to watch my rage come and go with such spontaneity."
So that's genius, isn't it?
It is.
Just watch it come and go. Be content about it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Let's say hello to our guest, Rosie Green, who Lorraine and I have known forever from our magazine days, as she's a super successful fashion and beauty journalist, as well as a social media star with her Life's Rosie website, Instagram account, and newsletters. Today, though, she is going to be talking to us about going from heartbreak to happy and starting again with love and relationships in midlife.
Yes, Rosie's first book, How to Heal a Broken Heart, is out in February, and in it, she explores the end of her 26-year relationship with a man she met at university, the man who was her husband and the father of her two children. He left the family home just 3 days before Christmas in 2018. In the aftermath, Rosie has chronicled how she's built a new life for herself and rediscovered her midlife mojo and is dating again. So welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Rosie.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I kind of wish it was like all together, but you know, it's good on Zoom.
Well, it's as good as it gets right now for us, but it's lovely to see you. Now, we've known each other for nearly 20 years on and off in the fashion and beauty world, and you're really one of the most positive, upbeat people I've known. And you used to write this wonderful column about your life and your family life and your husband, Alpha Male, as you called him. So for me, and I think a lot of us around you, it was such a shock when it all came to an end. So tell me what happened.
I wrote that column for years, and I got together with my ex-husband at university. So we've been together for a really long time, and I sort of called him the kind of constant in my equation, because I am this kind of super bubbly positive person, but I kind of needed that bedrock of somebody being there. And we had this sort of lovely idyllic life, and you know, we kind of moved out to the country, and then I was writing the column for Red. Suddenly, out of the blue, this kind of blindsiding moment where he was, you know, he was just like, "I don't love you anymore. I don't love you in that way anymore." The line that you never want to hear. And he just kind of started acting in ways that I, you know, didn't recognize. He just wasn't the person that I recognized, and he didn't want to stay in the marriage. He wanted to leave, and he wanted to move out. And you know, there were all these kind of confusing things to me that you know, really made me question everything, because he was so definite about stuff. So he'd say, "I'm moving out, I'm not telling you where I'm going." And I'd say, "Well, I don't think that's normal. And don't the kids need to know where you're living?" And he'd say, "No, you're being ridiculous. You're being controlling," you know, all this kind of stuff. So I was just in this world of pain. And for me, it did come out of nowhere.
This was Christmas 2018. So it was 3 days before Christmas, which is kind of a horrific time for someone to leave you.
Well, it had been going on actually since the summer. So the summer was when he came back with this kind of huge, you know, announcement. And then I just really tried to hold on. I was trying to do anything I could, because
you tried to fix it.
I tried to fix it, you know, but in doing so, that kind of just depleted me so massively, because it was like throwing myself against a kind of brick wall. You know, he was out basically, and we go to these horrific like marriage counseling sessions where I'd, you know, be like, you know, like this sort of little dog, like, I'll do this, I'll do, you know, anything.
It's very common for women to do that, isn't it, to try and make it work, even though they're not sure they want to make it work.
Well, at that stage I was so in the headlights actually that I the idea of losing everything was just so horrendous that I didn't even, you know, all my friends were like, but he's not behaving, you know, this is not okay. You know, you deserve more than this. But I was just so obsessed. And actually, in my book, I did quite a lot of research on it. It's almost like a junkie withdrawing from heroin. You kind of crave that fix because I think your ego is so doesn't want to deal with that rejection and is so frightened of the uncertainty. It'll do anything to kind of keep the status quo, basically.
But he'd been in your life almost longer than he hadn't been in your life because you were so young when you met. Yeah,
yeah, and no,
so
he'd been it longer.
So when he left then, what was the actual day-to-day impact on you in that sort of initial aftermath?
Actually, the sort of lead up to him going was the worst thing, because he was there, but he was not there. So he was coming back. But, you know, we've all got kids, you know, they still needed to have their recorders packed. They still needed to do exams for their next school. They still needed to be fed at night. So I was this kind of, you know, just trying to sort of be normal for them. I mean, in a way, thank God they were there, because, you know, it kind of kept me going. I found it very hard to sleep at night. So I sort of started taking these sleeping pills. And then I went to the doctor and I just said, look, you know, I need some more of these sleeping pills. She said, look, I think you just need to go on some kind of like low dose antidepressant, anti-anxiety thing, because, you know, your weight's like falling off a cliff and you can't. She just said, I think it'll give you some clarity. So they maybe took a month to click in. And from that point, I did feel a bit steadier. And actually, weirdly, I always had this survival instinct. So I always knew I wanted to, you know, I kept working, I kept functioning. I didn't feel like I could just go and lie under a duvet. I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Did you blame yourself for it?
Retrospectively, I sort of looked back and tried to work out how I could be better in my next relationship, or how all the things that I would do to contribute to it. But actually, that was so hard, because, you know, obviously he was saying, I'm leaving because you have been controlling, or I'm leaving you because you've pushed me too far financially, or I'm leaving you for all these reasons. So it's like a double whammy of you kind of totally questioning yourself. So, and all the marriage counseling was about, because he was the one saying I want out, was sort of about looking at me and saying, okay, what is she doing wrong? So, you know, that was just enormous in my head. So I did kind of question myself, and there was stuff like he wanted to go to the gym every morning at 5 o'clock, and I'd be like, well, do you not want to sit and have breakfast with the children ever, you know? And those kind of things where I think, is it reasonable? Is it not reasonable? It made me question all those things about what was reasonable, what wasn't. And obviously some of it was reasonable, some of his requests, and some of it wasn't, which is a very long way of saying, yes, I did question myself.
Yeah. And the children, I mean, having to support the children through this as well, while you're just kind of on the floor, how did you manage that?
That was heartbreaking, you know, having the conversation with them about, you know, daddy's going to go. And because they didn't see it coming, you know, it wasn't like we argued a lot. I mean, we did have arguments and stuff, but I don't think any more than any other couple. So they were totally blindsided too. They're kind of egocentric, aren't they, kids? So they obviously they cared about me and they could see that I was really struggling, but, you know, they needed me. They were kind of sobbing and crying and not going to sleep and lashing out and doing all those things. So to kind of dig deep and have the strength for them was just really hard.
Did you actually get divorced? Did you go through an official
divorce?
Right. So
long process.
Is it? When did you decide that that's obviously what you need to do?
I actually just thought I need to take control of this. So actually it's at that point, I think it was probably about he left, as you said, or he said, finally, it's over, it's over, it's over, in just before Christmas. And then probably by about February, I was like, okay, we need to get divorced. And I instructed a lawyer. And from that moment, I just felt like I had a bit of the, you know, I filed for divorce. And at that point, I thought, okay, that makes me feel a bit better.
And how did you find a lawyer? How do you find, I mean, because obviously the finances are meshed, everything is entangled, isn't it? What's the kind of, you know, practical advice?
Even our kind of like iPhones were linked. So, you know, like all our contacts are the same, everything, you know, our emails were linked, everything. This is why I kind of want to help people, because I feel like I'm in a really privileged position. I have a family of doctors and lawyers and, you know, I'm very lucky. And actually a really good friend of mine, massive overachiever, is like a family legal judge. She said, the best barrister I've ever worked with is X. And so she said, I think you should speak to her. And the barrister said, the best lawyer I've ever worked with is X. So she gave me this lovely woman called Sarah Lambert at Bowles & Co. She's amazing. And she gave me some really good advice because she was like, you don't want an absolute bulldog, you know, because actually all you're then going to get is two lawyers like this, and you really don't want to go to court. I mean, that's 30k before you've sneezed if you do that. You know, you want to try and make it as amicable as possible, and so therefore you want two lawyers that are actually going to work together to try and not spend all your money before you've even kind of
worked out. Yeah
And actually, practically, she signed up something which is called collaborative law, which is they sort of, the lawyers have to sign an agreement and sign up to a code that means that they won't be antagonistic and they will try and find the best solution and they will put the children first. And you know, she said to me that's her number one thing that she will always come back for and say, you know, what do you want at the end of the day? And it's, you know, it's for the children to get through this with as, you know, little trauma as possible.
And are you in contact with your ex-husband or soon to be ex-husband now? How does that work with parenting?
I mean, yes, I am. And actually, we have a sort of much more cordial relationship now. And we can talk about the children. And it's tough because I think if you haven't got children, you'd just break up with someone, you'd never see them ever again, right? But actually, you know,
after 26 years, I mean, it's sort of a whole chunk of your life that you would be walking away from.
So we are in touch, but I'm, you know, I see him when he gets the kids or he comes to the house to see the kids and that sort of stuff. But I just try and keep really clear boundaries because I don't want to be friends. I don't want to enter that zone where I, you know, emotionally I'm confused about stuff. So I'm very much like, we have a functionally friendly relationship, as this divorce coach once told me.
Did you have therapy, Rosie? Did you have someone to talk to about this? Because when you walk away from that, you're walking away from a big part of you.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what I did? I mean, I did the marriage counselling and then I went to see her a couple of times afterwards on my own. And then I did go and see a nice counsellor lady. Although, I mean, I find that all so weird. I'm like, can you just tell me what to do for a start? They go,
specifics.
And also, she was like quite deadpan and sort of just reflected everything back. And well, as you've said, I'm all like the jazz hand. So I was like, oh, you know, I'm just trying to make you like me, basically.
Oh, no.
She was quite good in terms of techniques. Actually, she was more helpful in the stuff around like new relationships. So how not to kind of repeat those patterns or, you know, I kind of definitely felt like I needed to be in a relationship to sort of be valuable almost or to be desirable or any of those things.
So being on your own, being single for the first time really in your adult life, at what point did you start becoming comfortable with that?
Do you know, I'm not sure that I could honestly confess and say that that was the case. I got to the stage where now in the house, there's the three of us. So at night when I lock the door now, I don't feel that sort of crushing sadness. But I do have to say, I you know, I'm somebody happiest in a relationship. But what I'm really pleased about now is that I feel like I don't like need that relationship to kind of complete me. It's like the extra level of happiness. I can be less needy of it for kind of to hold up my self-esteem.
Can you see, coming from your vantage point, why many women, and I know women, stay in really bad marriages they don't like?
I mean, that is one thing that I'm so grateful for. I would have stayed there. I would have, you know, he'd set all these rules up for how it would have to be if we stayed together. You know, I will have to go to the gym, my job will have to come first, and I will have to do that. And I would have totally, even though I think I'm a really strong person, I would have laid down and taken that. Because just the alternative, the idea of, you know, telling the children, the idea of dismantling the finances, the thing of just not having that kind of safety net, I would have stayed there. So I can totally see why people would.
What's your advice then for women going through that? Because you seem so much happier now than perhaps people who knew you before, even in the happy part of the marriage, would have thought you would be. If someone's husband has just this minute walked out this week, what would you advise them to do?
For me, that sort of vulnerability, that being open with people, because I still think there is a level of shame. Like, you know, people were so amazing. And there was this one lady, she was still really lovely. And she just, I remember telling her, and she just said, oh, well, you know, you must feel no shame. And, you know, I think actually there is an element of people not telling others because they A, have been battered down a bit, but also they kind of feel, you know, they feel there's an element of shame and guilt. So therefore they don't get the help. They don't get the help from their friends. They don't get the help from their family. So I would say, talk about it, you know, reach out to people. That sort of sharing, the way, you know, people now write to me their stories and I might put them on Instagram, and then they get the kind of, they get almost get a clarity by sharing it with other people.
They don't feel alone.
Yeah.
Or to blame.
Or to blame. Or there's also a massive thing of like, I mean, I remember Googling in the beginning, like, who's this happened to? So I Google like Ben Affleck's wife, you know, Jennifer Garner. I think, okay, she looks like a really decent person, and he's obviously done her over massively. So I'd be like, yeah, it happens to good people. And I feel like that's almost the sort of validation you need at that point.
And now the next phase, you've started dating.
Yeah, so I had sort of two phases. So for me, you know, I had never been on a date. I mean, I kind of got, you know, I'd done all the drunken snogging and the sort of gone to university.
When you were a teenager.
Yeah, exactly. And so therefore I just never done it. But I knew that it was part of the kind of journey. And also this divorce coach lady, she's called Sarah Davison. And she was like, actually, it's really good to kind of just put yourself online. I remember going on this divorce retreat and she said, you know, you have to write your biggest fears. And mine was like, nobody is ever going to love me ever again. Like, and I totally 100%.
Oh, I want to hug you, Rosie. Oh. I want to hug you. You're so lovable. You're one of the most lovable people.
Oh, thank you. And I genuinely just thought, actually, you know, am I just going to spend my days surrounded by cats? And that's totally fine if you want to do that, but I knew that wasn't what I wanted. And she said, just go online and you'll get some validation, you'll get people liking you, and you know, that'll make you feel better. I went away with, I don't know if you guys know Nadine Baggett.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I went to this like her, well, it was very good, this detox spa, I mean, where we couldn't eat any food, which was not good for me because I was about 8 stone at the time, and we were so bored. And she was like, okay, I'm gonna sign you up to Hinge. So we're like flicking through Hinge, like thinking, this is brilliant. Like, it's like the man shop. And instantly I kind of made some connections, things like that, and did lots of sort of flirting, and then went out on maybe 3 or 4.
Did people send you nude pictures? A friend of mine's on that site, and just these men just keep sending her pictures of their genitals.
Their genitals. I didn't get any genitals pictures. Oh. I have to say,
because
another friend of mine said she just got loads of like up nostril shots and kind of lots of in bathrooms taking pictures of their torsos when they really shouldn't be doing. I thought the quality was pretty high.
Back at last,
yes, this is good. So from that, kind of got this pool of like 4 or 5 guys and sort of started going out on these dates. And I have to say, I just really quite enjoyed it. I really remembered that I was quite a good flirt.
What happened on the first date? Did you spend like 3 hours deciding what to wear? And did you go out thinking, this is bizarre, how am I going to do it?
So my first date actually was with this photographer guy who came through my Instagram DMs. And he was definitely only just 30-ish.
I mean,
and he was Rosie. Really cute.
Look at Trish, gone all bothered.
He was really cute. And we went out for dinner and he booked Lino Stores in Soho. And I thought, well, my ex wouldn't know that if he like literally came and slapped him in the face. So I was like, this is exciting. I'm going to a nice restaurant. This was like 7 o'clock. Like by 9 o'clock, I was snogging in the Groucho Club.
Oh, I love it. How weird is that, snogging someone after 26 years of snogging the same person?
Exactly.
But it seems to me that it's easy to do and we shouldn't be worried about it.
Yeah, well, so
ask Trish, we might
actually probably even snog your husband. I mean, maybe you two do, but maybe that was the problem. I wasn't doing much snogging by this stage. That last, you know, it was just like fun, and obviously it was like entirely never going to go anywhere, but it was really good for the ego. Mm-hmm. And then after that was sort of dying, that's when Nadine and I signed up to Hinge. And then there were a couple of guys on that I saw, you know, that were more age appropriate and really lovely. And then one of them sort of turned into a boyfriend. It was lovely, and it was really distracting, and, you know, it was really good fun. And it made me realize there are sort of different kind of people out there. And in a way, it made me realize that my ex and I had got to a point where we were quite different. So to go out with people that really, you know, I was really interested in, and yeah, that was really good. That one then ended. So then I just got back to the man shop and then found another one.
But did you, I'm going to ask the question, did you, the first time you spent the night with someone, how did that feel from your confidence? point of view.
For the book, I interviewed this really amazing woman called Dr. Karen Gurney, and she's a sex doctor. And she was saying that the biggest fear for women is body anxiety.
Yeah.
And the biggest fear for men is performance anxiety.
Because you're taking a new body out that you haven't used before, because the first one was 18.
Really terrifying story. So this friend of mine, she said that she had a lot of children. And she said she went out with this really young guy, and he was like, midway through, it's like, can you just make it a bit tighter?
Like magic. Wave vagina wand over this.
Oh, exactly. My God, crushing. Crushing.
Yeah, exactly. So the crushing reality that I treated it like anything that I professionally get worried about. So if I've got like to give a big speech or I've got to do various stuff, I just did that sort of like 1, 2, 3, fuck it thing. I was just like, it's going to be fine. And also I do think there is... You do suddenly start like taking care of yourself a bit more. I have been working out more because like I've got more time. And also I think you just sort of think, okay, I'm going to embrace this. So I wasn't so worried about my body and those kind of things. I was more worried about the vulnerability of my emotions, that in a way, if I slept with someone, I would kind of fall in love with them. And I just thought in that way. But I was pleasantly surprised that I could have sex and not fall in love with someone. Just have a nice
What advice would you give to women who are thinking, I'm just not going to do that because that'll make things worse, or it'll make me feel bad, or I'm not confident?
I would say you really think about how ready you are. Don't get yourself into a situation where you're doing it for them. Don't get yourself in a situation where you're too pissed to make that decision properly. If you take control and you own it and you say, do you know what? Nothing may come of this, but I'm going to have a nice night. I read a really good book that a friend of mine gave me called It's Just a Date. And it's written by that guy who he was a screenwriter for Sex and the City. They're just really good at kind of like, you know, just don't expect too much. Don't like project 10 years into the future where you've married them. Just have a nice evening. Mm-hmm. Have a nice, but also kind of don't give it all away too much. Just keep your own boundaries and barriers up.
I guess when you've got family as well, you have to manage that because you don't want to bring anyone into your kid. What are your thoughts around that?
I agree. I think you have to be really careful there, and that, you know, they're so vulnerable and delicate, and sort of parade of new guys through. I don't think, I mean, for me, it has to be really kind of feel permanent or you know, be a long-term thing to do that.
Being single, Rosie, it's not just your family dynamic that changes. It's kind of the dynamics with friends, with wider family. How was that? Did you feel kind of suddenly very different in your relationships with other people?
I think I worried that I would be. I think there's an element of, there are probably some kind of dinner parties going on that I'm not invited to and all that sort of stuff. But I don't, weirdly, that doesn't really bother me. I feel, you know, the overwhelming thing is that people have been incredibly supportive and incredibly kind, and actually made me realise that I've been doing a lot of that by myself anyway, really. Mm-hmm. So it was more like the idea of him rather than him actually being there. So I think most people were amazing, and there are a few people that just couldn't, for whatever reason, handle it, and they couldn't, obviously it triggered something in them or triggered certain fears, or they just didn't have the brain space. And I just tried really hard to be philosophical about that and think, you know, sometimes people can step up and sometimes they can't.
And being on your own, because it is being in your own company, where so rarely, if you're in a relationship, you've got kids, just actually being on your own, are you comfortable with that now?
No.
Okay.
I hate being on my
fair
own.
Fair enough.
I
hate it too. I'm not that person. I like an office. I like a busy home. I like a dog. I like all those things. And so I don't think that's necessarily about the relationship but I do now, you know, it's like all those times which would feel really bad were like in the car, you know, when you just haven't got the distractions. Mm-hmm. And now in those moments, I'm totally fine. So I'm, you know, I feel much better about those things.
You're okay with songs that remind you, all those moments that might remind you of, because they're kind of little landmines, aren't they? Emotional landmines that drop in around us after 26 years of being with the same person.
Weirdly, I'm all right about all those things that are in the past. So like, for instance, you know, like I walked past the church that we got married in the other day and all that sort of stuff. I'm all right with all of that stuff, but there are a few songs around that period. And even the kids, like there are certain ones that the kids sort of freeze up, and they were the ones that were happening around the time of the split.
Mm-hmm. Christmas is just literally around the corner, looming 2 years. How do you feel about that?
I sort of did an Instagram post the other day because I know how hard it is for people, because it is, you know, it's kind of that sort of super sentimentality and those pictures of the big families coming through. 2 years on, I feel fine, actually. And, you know, I have got a nice new boyfriend, and so I will be with him and the kids. And so actually, I sort of feel like it'll be really, I think it'll be really nice. And actually, even last Christmas, we went to my cousin's, we had a big Christmas, and actually even last Christmas was nice. I mean, it was sad, but this year I think I'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. Have you managed as a single mum?
It took me so long, and then somebody said to me, oh, you're a single mum. I was like, shit, I am. Like, I didn't even think about it. But actually, I think like a lot of women, I've been, it didn't, the day-to-day stuff, I realised I'd done most of that, you know, the washing and the cooking and the cleaning, and and there was certain stuff that I didn't do. Like, I hadn't done, wasn't very good at bills. So I still need to get a grip on those. But a single mum is fine, actually. But the teenage years, which I'm navigating now, I sort of think that thing with my son about, you know, that kind of not having a big male in the house. And, you know, now I sort of say to him, you need to give me your phone. And I'm kind of looking up at him and I think, well, I can't physically take your phone from you anymore. There's that. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up in a single parent house and my mum was really lovely, but all I ever wanted really was that big family. So I feel really sad for them that they don't have that.
So you've been on this journey from heartbreak to happiness, as you call it, on your fabulous website, and your Instagram account is amazing. And I urge everybody to follow it because it's so joyful and uplifting. And the book is out in February. Where are you now on the journey from heartbreak to happiness?
Well, I would say that I'm nearly there. I have this lovely friend who has been on a similar timeline to me. And we, you know, we do have those dips, and they are quite a lot about the kids. Or sometimes you grapple with the unfairness of it. You think, you know what, I've got to sort out trying to get a new mortgage, or we might have to sell the house, or all that stuff. And none of this was my choice. And maybe some of it was my doing, you know, you kind of have to look at that. But so sometimes that kind of rankles, and sometimes I still question myself, but generally I'd say I was sort of 90% there.
Oh, that's brilliant news. It's really good to hear you happy with a new boyfriend, which we want to hear all about.
Yes, next time. Yes, indeed. Oh, Rosie, thank you so much for joining us on Postcards from Midlife. It's always a joy to be with you and be in your company. And we wish you a very happy Christmas and lots of luck with the book next year.
Oh, well, thank you. Bye, for Rosie. Having me. It's so lovely to see you both.
It's time for What Would You Do, in which we share a midlife dilemma about family, friends, or parenting. And this week we're asking, what would you do if your teenager just stops communicating and won't speak to you, which is a habit I think they probably all get into at some point during adolescence. How have yours been with that, Lorraine?
Well, I've got four kids, three of them are teenagers, so I would say of the teenagers, two are very communicative and it's fine, and one is very non-communicative. I'm an over-communicator, as you know, Trish, and really? My husband is an under-communicator, so he's not really used to talking either. But I think when kids do that, when adolescents do that, you have to keep some kind of connection with them. Mm-hmm. So they might not want a verbal connection, they might want some kind of other non-verbal connection, whether it's just sort of being in the room with them at the same time, like deliberately making sure you're in the room, just pottering around behind them or sitting next to them on their bed when they're doing something and just watching them do it. I think you have to just keep that up and keep up a few rituals that you used to do when they were little. You just keep doing it when they're older, so you are sort of, because they say all behavior is communication, don't they? So in a way, if you've got a non-communicator or a sudden non-communicator, just being a bit more. But you've got some actual tips, haven't you?
Yes,
from
I have.
Kai Graham and the Teen Toolbox.
Exactly. So Kai Graham, she is a parenting coach. She's written a really amazing book called The Teen Toolbox. And I had a quick chat with her because she's got this really simple technique, especially at the moment when things are pretty stressed and strained, everybody's having a hideous time. You know, home really needs to be a sanctuary. And if you've got this tension because a teenager isn't talking to you and you're kind of harassing them because you want them to talk to you and tell them what's going on, and they're, you know, it does create a bad atmosphere. this. So it's better to just try an approach that is going to work for you because it will give you a bit of information and reassure you. And it'll work for them because they don't have to give you too much information. And she calls it three questions. And what you have to do is, first of all, it's you get to a point where you need to say to your child, listen, we're not communicating very well. I need to find out what's going on, but I understand that you don't really want to talk that much. Can we just try this thing? Let's try it for a week and see how it goes. And usually kids should kind of be okay with that because, again, they're not having to give away too much and, you know, they want to keep you happy a little bit and get you off their backs, quite frankly.
Well, they want to know you care, don't they?
Yes, exactly. They're not going to get the Spanish Inquisition. The first question to ask is, what's your number? And that is asking them on a scale of 1 to 10 how they're feeling. And literally all they have to do is say 1 is like terrible and 10 is really happy. And then you start getting a feeling if they keep saying, oh, I'm about a 3 or a 4, but you don't question it. You just ask for the number and you start building up a picture. The second question you ask is, what is your word? And they have to give you one word that describes how they're feeling. So it could be happy. It could be sad. It could be tired. It could be bored. It could be. And again, that's it. They only have to give you that word. And again, you're sort of building up a picture. Picture and using these words as a benchmark for how your child is feeling. And then you say the third question, the magic question, do you want to talk? And 95% of the time, they're going to say no. If they say no, you can say, well, fine, but I'm here now or whenever you want to talk. If they say yes, it's like, do you want to talk to me? Do you want to talk to dad? Do you want to talk to Uncle John? You want to give it to them and put it in their control. Yeah. So they are controlling this conversation that they're going to have. She says it's very effective. It works for so many of her clients. And you can see how, I think it's so simple, but you're just simple, but you're going to get what you want. The teenager's going to be able to manage it in a way because they're, you know, they're growing up. Part of what they need to do is their independence. They start keeping their cards close to their chest. Yeah, exactly.
Forming their own identity. There's another thing you can do called the 6-minute conversation. What they don't want ever is to think that you might be talking to them for a long time. So if you start it by saying, can we just have a 6-minute conversation, and you keep it to a time limit and you've got into a bit of a habit of that, then they don't ever feel like it is the Spanish Inquisition. This is going to go on for 3 hours and they're going to have to give lots of information they don't want to get. So kind of time limited conversations are good. Exactly. So those are the things that you can do if your teen stops communicating. But it must be said, if they stop communicating very suddenly and other things are worrying you, then you do need to talk to an expert about it. And perhaps, you know, if they look unwell or other health concerns are around, then perhaps talk to your GP.
We have arrived at the helpful, practical, and hopefully life-changing part of the podcast, How to Win at Midlife. Because it's that time of year, that time of life, that time of day when we look around and realise we need some systems, we need some processes and organisation in place. So we need to be more organised in order to free up some of the time that we have to have more fun, don't we?
Yes, Rain? I want to get out and about. So you've been helping me a little bit with being organised this week, just very simple things that have changed my life. Sorting out my desktop on my laptop, putting it all in folders, working out which was my personal email, which was my work email, trying not to make sure those things crossed over so you get a bit confused. So it is a little bit about systems, but there is a really brilliant quote about being organized and starting your day well. I like to get up really early and do things and think, so if it's your job to eat the frog, eat the frog. If it's your job to eat the frog and there are two frogs, eat the biggest frog first. So basically, get the worst stuff out of the way, the most difficult stuff out of the way at the beginning of the day. And that clears the way for the rest of the day. I remember actually being at an event with Melinda Gates, Bill Gates' wife, who's probably the world's most organized woman. And she was a working parent, and then she was a stay-at-home, and then she was a working mum. And she said one of the things that changed her life is every time there was a meal in the house, everyone would get up and disappear. So she had this rule where she said, no one goes anywhere for 15 minutes. Everyone just stays in this room and sorts this out with me. And in that 15 minutes, quite a lot of stuff got done. So I'm going to start doing that every time everyone gets up here from dinner. I also follow Mrs. Hinch on Instagram. Do you know of her?
Yes, I do. Cleaning lady.
My goodness. She will save you hours. Go through her Instagram account. I'm not really into the Marie Kondo thing of
too much.
But there are some basics of the Marie Kondo, which I think are very helpful, is giving everything in your house a home. So if you give everything that you own a home, a specific home, then you don't have to duplicate it. Mm-hmm. So you don't get another one because you've lost that one. It all, and everyone has to be aware of that. I also rung Sarah Tomchak, who's the editor-in-chief mm-hmm. of Red magazine, which is full of tips on cleaning and clearing and being organized. And she said one of her best tips on being organized is to have a sharing agreement of tasks at home. Now, this is not something you just chat about. This is something you write down. All the tasks written down, who is doing what, and then you just keep reviewing that, particularly as the children get older, and it's really good for early morning routines. She says, you know, baskets, boxes, all of that, things having a home, really important. And a friend of mine who is a teacher advises parents to have a uniform drawer and a home drawer. Now that's, we've got two children with no uniforms, so, but I've still got those two drawers, so this is where to school, wear at home, and that has made such a difference because then you know everything needs to be washed and what doesn't need to be washed. We got rid of the shoe basket this week, Trish.
Right, the smelly shoe basket. Where are the smelly shoes going now?
Shoe basket was causing quite a lot of trouble because it wasn't divided and everyone was looking for their shoes and throwing things all over the place. So actually now they just go in a row.
Oh, okay.
Oldest to youngest, they go in a row. There's a lot of thinking around pre-planning, and I know when we spoke to the lady who runs the insomnia clinic, if you write down things, you don't worry about it in the night. Yeah. So that does absolutely help as well. There's a really nice website called Mason Haven, which is stylish reordering of your life. I think it's quite helpful. And there's quite a good Instagram feed called The Crap Flat. This is someone who lives in a really tiny flat, and she talks about how she really organises. So, for example, if she's going to store clothes, she'll put 10 things on a hanger, a bag over it, elastic band the top, and then write on the white plastic bag what is in it. Oh, it's just really good, really useful stuff.
I was wondering about apps because I'm not brilliant with apps, but there's a whole bunch of apps out there that if you are a kind of quite a techie person who likes doing everything on your phone, there's one called Focus that's all about organizing your day into 25-minute sections. There's one called Kitch that apparently you scan your supermarket receipts and then it keeps an update of what's in your cupboards and what you can cook. Which,
my gosh, that's God.
I mean, I just prefer to look in the cupboard. And there's also something called Family Wall to organise. Because, you know, in the non-digital world, you stick something, calendar up on the wall and you have everybody's activities. But there is one that you can use on your phone. So to me, that means like more time and thinking and organising to use these apps. But I know they work really
Some people like them,
super
don't they?
Well for some people.
See-through containers. That would be my main advice. Because the moment you put anything in something that isn't see-through, you've got, it takes a little bit more time to work out what's in it, and nobody puts the lid on anything in our house.
Well, I have to say I'm quite lucky in that I'm married to a man who is obsessed to the point of slight concern about things being in the right place. He will even go in, so if, say if we go and see friends,
Neil,
stay with
this
friends,
is Neil,
this is Neil, that's the guy, he'll open their cupboards and start rearranging their canned goodies into putting all the labels facing forwards, that kind of thing.
My husband is like that as well. It's a weird thing.
It's a bit special.
And we share an underwear drawer for a variety of reasons.
What?
So complicated, I can't even go into them. And his side is colour-coded, super organised. And mine looks like some kind of small animal has been in and ruffled it around. Because I'm all right if the drawer is shut, I don't care.
Oh my God, knickers everywhere, knickers and bras everywhere.
That's the other thing you can do if you want to be more organised. Just marry someone more organised.
Exactly.
Move in with them. Is Neil for hire?
Yes, very good rates. Now it's time for nostalgia noodling. How far back have you gone in the time TARDIS this week, Lorraine?
Well, I've gone quite a long way back and frightened myself slightly with this one. But as we are the menopausal Morecambe and Wise, this is really sort of from the era of 70s TV. My son is always talking about words that shouldn't be used anymore. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine who is of that era, slightly older than us, used the word knockers the other day.
Oh, he wasn't talking about doors, was he?
No. This is a word we grew up with, isn't it, in the 70s and 80s for women's breasts. Can
breasts.
You imagine?
Yes.
And then I sort of went down a terrible kind of route of 70s words for women's
upsetting
lady parts. Upsetting myself. So there's strawberry creams was another one.
Oh, never heard of that one. But now I know it.
Now
it's imprinted. Yes.
Baps.
Yeah, baps. Yeah, remember those.
Jubblies. How are your jubblies?
Lovely jubblies.
Lovely jubblies. These are all wrong, aren't they? These are words that should not have been used in those.
Should I tell you what's wrong as well? Was what? The when your dad used to bring home the Sun newspaper and there would be the page 3 stunner with her breasts / knockers, and it would just be the newspaper on the coffee table. That wasn't very nice, I have to say.
Who in their right mind thought that you could put a naked, topless woman in a national newspaper?
I don't know. It's
terrible times.
Very strange.
Use the right words for your lady parts. That's what I say. I've got friends who call things like their front bottoms noo-noos and things like that. That's not... Just use the words, the right words.
Okay, we'll go with that. So I've been back to the church hall / youth club discos of the late 70s / early 80s. And in particular, do you remember slow dancing? I mean, I didn't get asked very often. I didn't get, well, in a way it is actually, because I didn't get asked very often, but when you did... What you'd have to put your hands on his shoulders, wouldn't you? And you'd have to
always make sure
some spotty boy who's the only person who would ask you to dance. And there'd always be like at least a sort of 6-inch air gap so that you'd no pressing against the knockers or the nether regions, I would say. And you'd be sort of shuffling around the floor to like always
AD in red. Lady in Red.
Lady in Red.
Yeah.
Or Always and Forever by Luther Vandross. I seem to
recall. Oh, I loved Luther Vandross. But would you have got sad if you were stood on the side and not being hardly pressed against?
Yes.
No knockers being touched.
Secretly, yes. Secretly, sort of, yes and no. I mean, I think just standing there wanting to be invisible because you know what I'm like, but equally also thinking, oh, please somebody notice me. And very occasionally they did. But, you know, it was funny old times in the old
I quite like the slow dance situation.
The slow dance. Do they do it anymore? I don't think they do. It's all bumping and grinding, isn't it?
Is that what happens when you spot a goldfinch? You and Neil, you spot a goldfinch, sets you off,
and
bumping and grinding.
Very contentedly bumping and grinding.
Bird watching, twitching.
Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Postcards from Midlife. Did you enjoy it? Well, if you did, we have more twaddle for you next week. And in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on our Facebook page and our Instagram to keep these conversations going.
Yes, thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed it, please tell all your midlife friends to tune in as well. Remember, you can subscribe from your podcast provider and please rate and review us too, so we can continue to bring you all the best midlife stories and helpful advice.
Once again, you can email us ideas or questions at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com. Goodbye.
Bye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.